Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. The world of genetics is an exciting place. If you're not engineering monstrous Franken-chickens, you're rewriting ancient history. Our next guest has been recently doing both, and his work extracting DNA from the feathers in Māori cloaks has shed light not just on the birds themselves, but on the cloaks' historic owners. Geneticist Craig Miller from Auckland University joins us now.
Well, Craig, welcome along. What was it that possessed you to embark on this project in the first place?
Well, the group that I work with have been interested in extracting DNA from ancient material for a long time. I used to be a forensic scientist, so I've had a background in extracting DNA from dead material. And it became obvious after a few studies that we'd conducted on Moa that, in fact, the potential to investigate some of the historic artefacts from New Zealand was a real possibility. So we became interested in it for that reason.
Okay, so tell me about your findings, basically.
Okay, we've done two real studies. The first study, we were contacted by a curator of cloaks called Harangi Takanawa, and she had found an unusual cloak in the Hawke's Bay Museum. And this cloak, it had been suggested to be actually made of moa feathers. And she knew that we had interest in extracting DNA from moa and asked us if we could actually identify these feathers and to see if they actually were moas.
And was it?
No, it wasn't actually. We were able to sample it non-destructively. So the feathers are actually tied into a flax backing. So when cloaks are made, there's a flax backing and then feathers are stitched into that backing. So the actual quill or the shaft of the feather is still there. And you can take just small amounts, millimetres of the feather quill, and then extract the DNA from that. When we extracted it from that a cloak, we actually took several samples from it. We actually found it was actually made of emu feathers.
Oh, emu feathers?
Yeah, and that was, it's not perhaps surprising that they could be mistaken. Emu are belong to a group of birds called the ratites, which is also the group of birds that moa belong to, and they are quite similar in some ways. Our conclusion from that was that these feathers either came from Kawau Island, where Governor Gray was known to have actually kept emus, but also the other possibility is, in fact, that these feathers were traded at around the time the cloak was made, probably 1850, its exact date is not known, there was a lot of trade between Australia and New Zealand in terms of timber and various flax and other items. So they could have been traded, and that's how Māori got them.
That is one of the really interesting things that comes out of your studies, isn't it? The way that you're able to then make educated guesses about how things may have happened. Tell us a little bit about your findings about the Kiwi cloaks and how they may not have all been from the regions that you'd expect.
Yeah, once we'd finished the study on the moa cloak, or the alleged moa cloak, which turned out to be an emu one.
This is so CSI right now, isn't it?
Yeah. We decided that we'd try and expand the study. And the next group of cloaks that are very prestigious, and there are a large number of them found in New Zealand, are actually Kiwi cloaks. They started probably being produced in New Zealand after Europeans arrived here, about from 1850 onwards. And there are a very large number of them actually in museums. And so the advantage with the Kiwi cloaks is that we have a very large database of the modern distribution of Kiwis. So in the case of the emu cloak, we could just identify it to the species level. So we could say this wasn't a moa, it was actually an emu, but we didn't know where the actual emu came from. So in expanding our study, we thought, well, if we took the same principle, but this time actually had a much bigger database of all the Kiwi around New Zealand, we could actually locate the provenance of the feathers. And that was
it. And that's interesting, isn't it? Because Māori tribal regions were very much about locations. And so you can make guesses about how trade may have happened or travel. What did you find?
Exactly. So what we found, we looked at about 109 different cloaks. Most of the cloaks that we looked at didn't have any provenance identified with them, so they had been collected and there wasn't much known about the history. What we actually found is that over 50% of the cloaks that we looked at came from one area in New Zealand, in the North Island and the east coast of New Zealand, so around the Gisborne, Uruwera sort of region, which was very surprising to us.
Is it possible that that's just where the cloaks were from originally?
It is possible, but and in fact, that is one of the possibilities. The interesting thing that we found, and we don't have a random distribution, obviously, of all cloaks across New Zealand, but what happened was that we have cloaks from Christchurch Museum and across New Zealand, and what we found is actually half of them came from that region.
Right. And so it's too much to assume that that was the only part of the country that had cloaks, or that's where all the cloaks came from. Or
exactly. But what we concluded was, in fact, that might have been, and logically, that was the origin of cloak making. And then the tradition started in that area and then spread out across New Zealand. Because these Kiwi cloaks, when Cook arrived in New Zealand, there weren't Kiwi cloaks fully covered cloaks. That's not what Cook found. In fact, when Cook arrived here, the cloaks were actually covered mostly with dogskin and quite different. And so cloak making developed very quickly after Europeans arrived.
Interesting. So maybe some of those findings about the trade between areas of feathers or of cloaks indeed was in a period after European arrival anyway, so perhaps links are not as unlikely to be found as they would have been to be hundreds of years ago.
Perhaps. What we found was that, in fact, that about, like I say, 50% of the cloaks came from this one area. But then when we looked at the cloaks in detail and took samples from all over the cloaks, what we found about is 15% of the cloaks actually had Kiwis from quite different areas, so from many hundreds of kilometres apart. And this suggested to us that either Māori at that time were moving on hunting trips out of their local region to go to other regions to get Kiwis, or they themselves were trading between the different regions to then construct these cloaks.
Tell me about the breakdown between male and female Kiwi, and it was more often to be male. Why was this?
So not only can we identify from the DNA the actual region that they came from and make a good estimate of the region, but we can also determine the sex. And so when we actually looked at the sex of the individual, there was about 60% were male feathers and only 40% were females, and we concluded from that in fact the males were probably easier to catch, and that is consistent with what we know. Males incubate the eggs and they are sitting on the eggs, and therefore they may have been much easier to catch and therefore are disproportionately represented in the
low-hanging fruit, as it were.
Exactly.
Go for the easy ones.
Nice to know that some Kiwi men are sticking in there.
I am interested though in the way that this that genetics plays into different areas of society. So obviously here you're working in a real sort of natural history side of things, which ties into anthropology. Mm-hmm. Is that standard for you? Is that you can?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously by the sound, you know, forensics, criminology, all these sorts of different disciplines that it sits alongside.
Yeah. So in probably the last 20 years, DNA technology has advanced massively. So when I started doing forensics, we found, you know, DNA typing and DNA fingerprinting was really in its infancy. And over the last 20 years, it's developed hugely. And the technology has gone up exponentially. So what's happened is that now many of the techniques that we might have used only in pure science or various areas of forensics, we can now apply right across the board. And so you see this sort of high-end technology coming down into questions that perhaps the general public are more can relate to and can actually discover the history of some of our past.
As these techniques develop, are we in many ways rewriting some of the accepted histories?
I think there's a possibility to do that. In some cases, we're confirming what was thought or what was lost. So many of the technologies and traditions associated, for example, with cloak making, although they've been passed down from generation to generation, some of that knowledge has been lost. For example, the provenance of many of these cloaks, they've been passed down from family to family, etc., and they've moved around the country. They've ended up in museums. So a lot of that has been lost, and what we're not so much rewriting, but we can recapture that knowledge, and even the way that they were constructed, so that they were, we can actually even look at the pattern of the feathers in there and see how many individuals, for example. We found that there was about at least 4 individuals used to make a cloak.
One last quick question. Are there moa feather cloaks out there?
Not that we know of. We've never. There are.
If you find one, can you use it to recreate a moa, like a Jurassic Park sort of experiment?
If we were, no. But if we were, the answer is no. But we are at a stage where if we are doing studies where we can express some of their genes, So we are doing studies, but we wouldn't go for feathers. We'd actually use bones. There are very many thousands of moa bones. In fact, moa bones are one of the most common subfossil bones. So for a study like that, we would go to a source which is much easier, and that would be the actual bones of the moa.
We'll have you, as soon as you manage to crack that one, we'll have you right back on here. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
And we'll be sure to keep you up to date with any developments from Craig Miller as they come to hand. Coming up after the break, the new owner-operator of Grooveguide and New Zealand music royalty, Liam Finn.